The general theme that we have is a meaning of Jesus Christ for the lifestyle of today. Taking a look at the relationship of our theology with a particular, specific, concrete lifestyle that can be appropriate and relevant for today's times. This morning we want to begin by looking at the church. Tomorrow, connection with God. Is God dead? Or is the church's idea of God dead? Who is God? How can we even speak of God? Wednesday, the Holy Spirit. How do we recognize the presence of the Holy Spirit? Thursday, morality, old and new. What are some of the symbols of restraint and symbols of encouragement? And then Friday morning, Jesus and the life of freedom and service. And tonight, John will focus particularly at 10 o'clock on Jesus Christ, the chief content of the new or radical theology. But this morning we want to begin by, in a way, looking at where we are as the church. And the operating procedure we'd like to move on is that John and I will be talking back and forth from our various perspectives. And you all jump in anytime you want to. We don't view ourselves as lecturing for 15 minutes or 30 minutes and then discussion, but as we go, you enter into the discussion so that it ends up 45 minutes, 50 minutes of give and take the whole way around. We have identified these areas as hopefully areas that are of interest and concern to you also.
Ready?
Right.
Ready?
Well, the bird's stumbling block is a very evangelical word. As you know, an offense or something that gets in the way is mentioned many times in the teachings of Jesus. It was evidently something that was on his mind, something that struck it out of its haunted cord in him, stones, rocks, this sort of thing. He talked about himself as being a cornerstone, as being a firm foundation, and he is talked about by his disciples in that respect. But also he mentioned the stumbling block, the offense. And one place, I don't remember my gospels very well, I'm not that good a Christian, but I remember he said it would be better if someone were to be an offense, a stumbling block to a little child, that a millstone be hung about his neck and be cast in the midst of the sea. That, in a way, is a text, if there is a pretext, for what we want to talk about this morning. The church has been very good for 2,000 years, roughly, at dishing it out, and has called many things stumbling blocks and offenses and odors of the nostrils of the pious and offenses against humanity and so forth. But perhaps what is new about the present situation, the situation since the middle of the 19th century, which would be just yesterday or just today really in history, is that the church itself has been recognized by those people that we would consider under any normal criteria sensitive and spiritual, good, if you will, whatever such a word could mean, has been recognized as a chief offense, the chief odor in the nostrils of the pious. It is the church that is the offense. It is the church that keeps men from bearing the Spirit. It is the church, perhaps not in all its manifestations, but at least in the majority of instances, that keeps us from making the world more Christ-like. I was accused a couple of weeks ago when I was lecturing at the Lutheran seminaries in St. Paul in Minneapolis of having nothing new to say, but of saying what an elderly gentleman, Dr. Alain, I think it was, said he heard when he was a young man taking his doctorate in philosophy years ago, Bertrand Russell saying. And I immediately thought that was very keen of Dr. Alain, who is a PhD in philosophy, because Bertrand Russell did say a good deal of things that I'm saying now a long time ago. It was this change. Bertrand Russell, he's still alive, I guess. I haven't seen the latest paper. He's very old, and he's very opinionated. But Bertrand Russell essentially represents a mid-19th century point of view. And when Bertrand Russell was casting the kind of criticisms at the church, he did, this was over 50 years ago, he did it consciously as an atheist. Not a Christian atheist, but an atheist. He did this consciously as a man who, because he was sensitive and moral, just opted himself out of the Anglican Communion, out of the Catholic Church, out of the mainstream of the ecclesiastical tradition. Just precisely because he felt the rub against his conscience, if you will, he opted out of the church. And what I had to answer Dr. Alain was this: the different situation today is that it is not people outside the church, but it is the church's own sons and daughters who are now saying the church is a stumbling block and an offense. I think this is interesting for two reasons, and I'll let you answer. The first is, I don't think the world outside is concerned any longer. We do not have any Bertrand Russells standing over against the church today because the church isn't worth it. Paul.
You use the term Christian atheist, and some of us here have an understanding of the present value of this term, and some of us do not. Would you care to define it according to your understanding?
Yeah, I'm not a Christian atheist, but some of my closest colleagues call themselves that. A Christian atheist is not an atheist in the sense that he does not believe in something larger than man. A Christian atheist is one who believes that in order to feel certain that Jesus Christ is his Savior, he has to confess that the God worshipped by the Western civilized tradition, which is Judaism, Christianity, the Greeks, is dead. Now, I have to say why. We have to say this because if God, the God of the Western tradition, is still alive, then Jesus Christ is of no effect, according to this line of reasoning. Because the God of Western civilized tradition has been preeminently a projection of the father figure and has represented what in psychological terms would be called repressions of the life instinct. In other words, this God is, in the words of Jonathan Edwards, a rather orthodox scholar, a spider. He is the devil. If you've ever read any William Blake, you know what we're talking about. The God of the Western tradition, the repressing, thou shalt not, the God who punishes the king because he doesn't kill the last woman and child, you know, in the captured city. The God that fills Samuel with the spirit so that he hacks Agag, the king, into pieces as an act of mercy. The God that would demand the death of Jesus Christ. This God must be dead or else Jesus is not Christ. This is what a Christian atheist is. This position is identified with Tom Alcott.
Thank you.
I would like to question your, or ask you a question about your use of the word offense. Hmm. Because as I understand Christ using it, he said, I am the offense, and the church ought to be an offense. And you're using it in another way.
Yeah, very good. He says, they will be offended at me. He didn't say it was an offense, but they will be offended at me.
That just means that I will offend the world.
But you are right that we're using offense in another way.
Yes.
We're using it as a stumbling block. That is, as something that keeps one from reaching the goal. And two things haven't been done so far in this discussion. That is, one, to talk about what the goal is, and secondly, how the church or whatever else X is in question functions as an offense. And you're perfectly right. There's offense A and offense B, if you will. We're talking about offense in a non-evangelical sense. The offense of Christ, first of all, to get that put in position, the offense of Christ is precisely the Protestant emphasis, the evangelical emphasis, that it is a question of the acceptance of Jesus as one's Savior rather than one's own goodness that determines his standing as a spiritual being. So this offense, of course, we could not possibly, in any sense as religious men, want to overcome or want to do away with. It's precisely for the proper understanding of the offensiveness which we say natural men or unspiritual men take us over against Jesus that we want to come clear. I think sometimes the preaching professors say that we must understand that the offense that we are to offer to the world is the offense of Christ's claim and not the offense of our personality, or the offense of our institution, if you will. Now, what kind, that's in, let's call that offense B. The second sense, a good evangelical sense of offense. I mean, we could do away with that too, but we would also do away with Christ if we were to do away with that. The first kind of offense, let me get this, Paul, so we have something to talk about. The first kind of offense is the stumbling block of the variety which Jesus evidently had in mind when he spoke to the Pharisees about their laying heavy weights upon the backs of the people of his day, laying these heavy burdens on them more than the yoke of his own servants, burdens which were unnecessary, burdens not only that were unnecessary, but that also prevented men, as he said, from entering into the kingdom. He said it was hard enough to do it with God's grace, much less without all these human offenses. That's the kind of Pharisaic offense that I have in mind about the church. And in a little write-up, which never got on the bulletin board, it got lost someplace, we mentioned some of them. Bureaucracy, for example. We can develop this later, but simply before I let Paul talk again. Clericalism. Confessionalism in the sense of narrow-mindedness, legalism, which of course we don't have to say much about here since Carol's always knocking that, rightly so, prejudice, racism, and I mean racism in its finest sense, Norwegians, you know, as being better than other people, Swedes, you know, mulattoes as being a little better than cold black Negroes and this sort of thing. The racism, which the Protestant church almost entirely is a company of racists when we come right down to it. Now that's what I had in mind there. Paul, and then I want to say something about what is the content that's being kept back. But go ahead.
Well, I've heard the offense of Christ defined in a very brief manner that has had a lot of mileage in the definition for me. You're inclined to define the offense of Christ as, or think of the offense of Christ as an offense to our intellect. Instead, he is an offense to our ego.
Mm-hmm. That's precisely the question. It isn't a question of intellect, since in the last analysis, I think this is what is wrong with theology, by the way, and confessionalism. It isn't what we know with our minds that is really determined. It is what we respond to as a total person, of which the intellect of mind is only a very minor part, actually. I don't believe anyone has ever become an atheist or a non-Christian because he couldn't believe, that is, in the epistemological knowing sense of something. He became offended primarily, as you put it, his ego, that is, from feeling tones. And I would say, very largely, this would tie in with the kind of thing Fred and I want to do this morning, because he is morally offended. And this not really, then, our response to the offense of Christ, but he is morally offended.
Can I just ask a question about definitions here? My understanding you correctly is that the church is a stumbling block to something?
Right, we haven't said what that something is yet.
No, what do you mean? You're not saying that the teachings of Christ are a stumbling block, you're saying the church, is that correct?
It would be very difficult.
The teachings of Christ are a stumbling block to a certain goal.
I would say both, since you want to raise the question. Because the church wouldn't exist without the teachings of Christ.
Well, would you define both of them? You're saying both that the teachings of Christ are a stumbling block to something good, and you're also saying that the church is a stumbling block to something good. Would you define the difference?
No, let's define them by saying that they overlap. I don't think we can know too much about the teachings of Christ. And this is what I wanted to get to. What is it that's being blocked back? I would think that any theologian would have to recognize that we can know very little about Christ historically, very little really about what he taught. But this is relatively unimportant. What is at issue, and the very thing that I feel and others like me, and I think it's a rather growing number now, a strong tradition, that is being, blocked by the stumbling block of the church and other institutions and other attitudes and feelings. What is being blocked is not some teachings of Jesus, not some doctrine, but the living presence of the spirit of Christ. This is what is at issue. Not what he taught, but what he is. What he is now today. This is what we're talking about.
What do you mean by the church now? Will you give some definition?
Sure. And let me say why the teachings of Christ then would have to be included, at least let us say what normally or traditionally is associated with the teachings of Christ would have to be included in what we call church. Church is, first of all, institution, which, of course, given the nature of the experiment that is the universe, is perfectly natural and perfectly necessary. Men associate themselves together. Men practice things, and they get into habits and rituals. Men do things over and over the same way. Things develop. If the church had not developed in the way it has developed, and of course it's taken every conceivable form, well, it would have developed in another way. Church probably has always been an offense and a stumbling block. But the point of the critique of, I don't like to say modern theology, but a recent theology since the middle of the 19th century approximately, is that it is more than ever a stumbling block. Now, what is the church? The church has conveniently and necessarily, for something like 1900 years, or probably 1600 would be better, codified what were considered to be the teachings of Jesus, before him the teachings of the prophets and the priests, the wise men, and after Jesus, the teachings of those who had been inspired by his life, his apostles, his disciples, and then the apostolic men in the hierarchy of the church. It codified these things so that they could be taught easily. Church came into being when the decision was made, however it had been made, that the world wasn't coming to an end next Saturday, but that we had to teach our children something about Christ and St. Paul and so forth, because they were going to live in this world probably all their lives and have children who also needed to be made more mellow, if you will, more loving and more civilized.
Would you consider the apostles to be a part of this church, or say the early church, are using it in that same sense?
Yes. We certainly would, because they were teachers. And of course the Gospels and the New Testament developed as logia, as little teaching manuals and so forth, at least as far as we can tell. Before that it was tradition, we say oral, the same thing. In other words, you might say church and catechism equal each other.
That the teachings of the church and the church are identical, is that what you're saying?
If they are not identical, one is the reason for the other. There comes a body of people who are concerned about something, call it X if you will, and therefore they must articulate their concerns in a relatively systematic way, and then logia, catechisms, gospels, scripture appears.
But it seems or like scripture one appears of the things you said about the bureaucracy and some of these other things would in some sense be different from what you identify as catechism.
How so? How do catechisms come into being and get authority? You know, we haven't had time to lay out what we're talking about yet, but it seems pretty obvious that when you have something you're concerned about, you want to systematize it so that you can teach it, so that you can understand it, bureaucracy will grow up.
There is a difference between what is being taught and how it's being taught.
Yes, but the unfortunate thing is that it is an ideal difference only. It's never real.
Well, just so I understand what you're saying.
Ideally, there should be, but it's never real. It never really exists.
Well, I don't want to agree or disagree, but I do want to understand what you're saying. Yeah. I think I do that.
Yeah, in other words, I could want to teach you Afrikaans and end up not really doing it, but actually what takes place is what takes place. Ideally...
Well, I understand what you're saying. Okay.
But the bureaucracy and the catechism, just as using these words as symbols now, approximate each other. One is the occasion for the other. A teacher is a bureaucrat, if you will. Again, there's nothing, you know, reprehensible about a bureaucracy or about an institution. This is simply the way the world is constructed, the way men are. We organize ourselves. And
well, I understand what you're saying, and that's why I asked the question, is in order to understand what it is you're saying.
Right, okay. So, the unfortunate thing is, even if we did have pure knowledge of what the teachings of Christ were, and that were really at issue, which I would deny, my own personal position, I would absolutely deny that this was of any value to Christ, God, or man, or anything else. except perhaps as an educational thing. Even if we had these pure teachings and we had the finest intellects and the best will in the world, you know, we could really meet Kant's position, working out of a disinterested and inactive goodwill, still the very nature of a bureaucracy extending over time, through space, would eventually lead to corruption, it would eventually lead to a breakdown, and so forth. So this, again, is a part of the historical fact of man's existence. I'm not concerned with all this sinful. What we're talking about is an offense in a much sharper way today, when added to, if you will, to use some terms from science, added to the natural resistance of the vehicle or of the agency through which one is working, added to the resistance, there becomes a corrosive effect on this vehicle or this this instrument, such that it completely chokes off whatever it is that's supposed to be passing through that medium. And that thing which is supposed to be passing through the medium of church would be the living presence of the spiritual Christ. He choked off. And to use my analogy, if it's indeed one, if this were a bar of some sort of electricity conducting substance, it would have a natural resistance within it. But now if that were modified in some way, such that it completely choked off, or almost completely choked off, what was passing through it, then it would seem, we could talk of it really as a stumbling block, really as a wall, if you will, really as an offense. And then I want to give this to Fred now, but to tip into what I'd like to go on to. Then, of course, if this electricity or whatever other agency were passing through this medium were choked off, it would have only one recourse, and that would be to pass itself through some other way. And that is precisely what has happened in the modern world.
I would like to speak, first of all, as a member of the bureaucracy. Now, they pay my salary,
and I'm one of the bureaucrats that does it.
So, yeah. He's my boss. And so we're speaking from being very much entwined in this bureaucratic setup, this institution, that is called the church.
Hey, Fred, before going any further, I think it's good that and a lot of people have asked me, you know, who's on today, who's talking, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it is useful to tell who you are. First, John Cooper. I mean, I think you should tell, you know, your position and your background, that you are a philosopher and a theologian.
Organizer of the Communist Party.
Something you better not say.
Tell who you are, Fred.
First of all, PK, preacher's kid. So, a part of this institution for 34 years. Presently, I'm on the Youth Commission staff of the Lutheran Church in America. Young adult work and leadership development. My background is a combination of educational training and psychological training, working both on the Senate staff in Pennsylvania and doing the pastoral council in Washington, D.C. before coming to this position. And the reason I am in this position was that while I was doing counseling, I became very much aware of, for example, the social agencies of the church as being somewhat of a almost autonomous, separate, but parallel structure to the church, and where I could in a way move much freer and be more directly involved in the ministry of healing, in the ministry of reconciliation. I felt I was outside of the bureaucratic structure. And so I came into this position hoping that in some way I could bring about a change in the bureaucratic structure of the LCA and hopefully in congregational structures. So that I am seeking to fight the church as a stumbling block, both on the congregational level where I'm a member and not a pastor, and then on the national level. Who are you, John?
I'm a Gentile. I'm a philosopher. I've just now moved to the Eastern Kentucky University to become chairman of the Department of Philosophy there. For the last 7 years, I was at Newberry College, which is an LCA college in South Carolina. I was the chairman of the Department of Philosophy there. Before that time, I graduated from two Lutheran seminaries, Southern Seminary in South Carolina, and Chicago Seminary, Maywood. I felt I had to go to seminary because I felt I got no Christianity at all in our Southern Seminary, just cultural religion. While I was there, they kept the Negro students from coming in by the students and the faculty protesting. I mean, this is a beautiful example of our love and so forth. So I went back to seminary and took a master's degree after my DD, so that I learned a little something. And before that, I graduated from the University of South Carolina, which was a much more Christian place than Newberry College or any other church college I've seen. Then I went on to the University of Chicago for my MA and my PhD. And that's about it. I've also taught at Peel College in Pennsylvania, which is an LCA college. I don't know what to say what I do. I write about 3 books a year on this general subject of Christianity. The philosophy of religion is my interest. And the 19th and the 20th centuries are my area, my field. I'm particularly interested in existentialism, phenomenology, and phenomenology is the attempt to describe in the most general terms all of the events that have happened in the world. If you want a very brief and simple definition of that, you might say phenomenology begins where psychology leaves off, when we want to know how we know the kind of things we feel. And that's a very illegitimate definition, but it's the way I proceed. And all of the things that I say and I do under this illegitimate rubric. I'm interested in the radical theology, the death of God movement, because at least it's alive. And so I've come back to being interested in theology again through that. I had all the other theological training, but I'm afraid I feel the way one of the boys in the prep school mentioned in the book, A Separate Peace, felt about Julius Caesar. He simply didn't believe that Julius Caesar ever existed. There ever was a Roman Empire, or that there ever was such a language as Latin. It was invented by the headmaster just to torture poor boys for 4 years in school. Okay. So, any other questions you want to check on? I'm glad you asked that, Leo.
I am too.
Wait a minute, I don't know. We haven't been trying for heresy all week. Okay, you talk about the church now. Maybe we ought to hit some of these things.
No.
We want to get back to that. Let's talk about some of these isms.
Keep in mind that in this statement we're making, it has both a positive and a negative. We start off with the negative, but we're using that as looking towards the positive, or what has become real for us and what we're fighting to make possible become real for others. The church as the stumbling block which prevents our coming into fellowship with the living spirit of Christ. Coming into fellowship with the living spirit of Christ. As a member of the clergy, one of the things that is rubbing me and paining me is that I'm seeing so many of our good guys leaving the clergy. And that we as the clergy think of them as the bad guys. And I'm beginning to wonder who is to call what good and who is to call what bad. I see, for example, some of the guys that I felt were most alive in seminary going out into the parish and seeking to help bring alive some of the things that have to do with this living spirit of Christ and getting trampled on by the congregation, by the lay people, and by the ecclesiastical structure which they are part of. I know one guy, for example, right now that is going into another helping profession. Not because he feels he's leaving the ministry, but because he feels that he can become a minister. That he can go about doing the work of the Lord in a way that he feels not just choked, that he's being strangled in the structure which he's a part of.
Yeah. Well, I see this a great deal because I hang out with the Gentiles, you know, and the bad guys. And of course, it's probably going to happen to me now that I'm going to work for the state. So I look forward to this with great interest at the end of the summer. But it is true that there's a pretty rapid draining out of our younger men. I would say our men, when they hit about 30 to 35, of the clergy today, and they tend to be the better educated ones, the more sensitive, the ones who've done more. Apparently, the ones who go out to Podunk Falls, there's only one Canadian around, so I'll say this, Saskatchewan or something, and take an 8-church parish, they stay for life, and a little problem. And you know, bureaucracy is a beautiful thing because it protects the weak. It's just exactly like the promotion system in the Army. All you do is sit around, you know, and you don't run up any bad debts, or go out with the colonel's wife, or anything like this. You don't lose any division, and you eventually will make colonel, maybe even general if you're lucky. And so the bureaucratic system is really Christian because it takes care of the weak, you know, the childlike, if you will. And this would be beautiful if these people understood this, but unfortunately, put on a good deal of the airs about it. But I'm more concerned about burning things than that. As far as I'm concerned, everybody should be able to have a niche in the world. That's just the way the world is, and that's fine. But I'm concerned about the conductor now, the institution, which at least should be letting some of the electricity of the living Christ trickle through, as choking that off more and more. And I think that in many occasions in my short life that I have witnessed and been part of this choking process that makes me talk out of something more than academic interest, and Fred, you too, and perhaps most of you.
Let's move into this confessional.
Right, into confessionalism. That's a beautiful one because part of the confessional position, at least historically identified with the Lutheran church, has been, you know, the two kingdoms. That two kingdoms is a very neat doctrine. It enables you to be a coward with a good conscience. And I think the two kingdoms of confessionalism will cover what I'm going to talk about. We have been living through crisis, of course, ever since Adam or Monkey or whoever else started the business started, but the crisis have been accumulating since 1900. We've lived through the crisis of coming to knowledge of how to utilize atomic energy, and is rapidly used, first of all, for destruction. We have come to a sensitization through the agencies of the world, not through the church, at least only indirectly through some people in the church at best, that all men are brothers, that we are one species, that if we don't learn to live together in peace, we will devour one another. And just not only the colored and the Indian and the Oriental and the white within the confines of the United States and Canada, but the Russian and the American, the Chinese and the Westerners, and so forth. These kinds of crises have come up. The crises in which we have learned that through scientific knowledge and technological adeptness, it is not really necessary that people die of the diseases that still continue to carry men off by the hundreds of thousands in the world. It is not really necessary that a good portion of the world be undernourished and hungry, that although there may indeed come a time when the world is not able to support its population, that time is not now. Distribution and attitudes have more to do than poor soil with the hunger that is a constant presence to so many people in the world, if not the great majority. And in these things, the church has not taken a lead, not even a back seat, but sometimes has taken an opposite position to the amelioration of the sicknesses and the agony and the conflict and the hostility in the world. Although they're great figures who identify themselves with the church and Christianity, like Martin Luther King, Catholic nuns and priests, got many Unitarian ministers, some Lutheran ministers, but very, very darn few. One of the comments I heard at the time of Selma was, we knew it was perfectly safe because we saw XYZ, who was a famous Lutheran professor, going down there. If it had been dangerous, he wouldn't have been there. And that was the implication from these Unitarians. And it did turn out to be fairly safe. But this is the kind of resistance, this is the kind of offense that we're talking about. And I don't want to get carried away just on this one issue, because essentially the civil rights struggle is over in this country. We are in the sort of a dead eye now of a civil war. I hate to say that civil rights is dead as such. And whatever comes out of this, I don't know just how much effect the church will have on it. This is part of my bitterness, if you will. But these kinds of things I would talk about. What is the living spirit of Christ? Seems to me that whatever we can gain in the most general terms from the picture of Jesus as presented in the gospel, and the picture which is even more important, the reverse image, if you will, the negative, the impress, if you will, the track that we can follow of Jesus throughout history, that is the effect he has had on men like St. Bernard, St. Francis, he's had on Albert Schweitzer, Martin Luther King, men, millions of men, most of them nameless, who have existed throughout these last 19-odd hundred years. Whatever it is that is constitutive of his living spirit is that he is healing. That essentially is what the Latin salvus means. Salvation means healing. We have bureaucratized that. We have sectarianized that, where it is some kind of mythical, some kind of unmundane, if you will, salvation or something, at best, perhaps an emotional jolt. But we have forgotten its fleshly origins, its world, its roots, its salvation. And the thing that comes across, myth to be sure, legend perhaps, certainly I don't think to be taken literally, and yet the implication is clear. What Jesus did was Jesus healed. I can find no fault with the commentator on the book of Luke that said essentially when we look at Jesus in the Gospels, when we look at the pseudo-stories in Josephus, when we look at the other records of the apostolic period, the thing that comes across, Jesus was a healer. And this is represented in terms of twisted limb, it is represented in terms of twisted mind, it is represented in terms of twisted relationships,
but it is your
twisted spirit, of course. Particularly the relationship, the broken center of men, it is represented as being a healing of fear. Peter in the bottom of the boat, you remember the story about the draft of visions, I think it was, the courage. Now, if there's any answer to the kinds of problems that have always afflicted men, but which have become of rather critical dimensions because of man's increasing knowledge and his mobility and the other things which you know about as well as I, in our day, it would seem that this kind of a healing is what is necessary. Now, today, of course, you can find thousands upon thousands of ministers and lay people in institutions like this one and others that are on this bandwagon, but you do not find it in its origin. I find that the man who speaks most clearly to me and speaks to all of the students that I've ever had any truck with and to most of the people that I'm able to talk with long enough so they get over feeling that I am the devil incarnate, which may in fact be the case, but is Albert Camus, who is not a Christian. I see his sermon to the Benedictines where he calls upon them. He says, if there is nothing, he says, in your tradition, is there nothing in your tradition that Jesus can join forces with Socrates? Is there nothing in your tradition that can opt, and these are not his words, but this is essentially what he means, it can opt for a small good even when we can't have an eschatological good, even when we can't save all children, maybe we can save one Algerian child. Even when we can't put the benediction upon all the children of North Africa, perhaps we can give a glass of milk to one child. This kind of feeling, as he said, so many of us during the war years, when the atrocities were being committed, when the Pope was in diplomatic relationship with the Chancellery of Hitler, when everyone knew and turned their backs on the Jews, he said, we waited for a great voice to come from Rome, and we never heard. Now, that's history. Most of us are too young to have been in the Second World War. There's some here that were. Most of us only know that as children. Some of us are so young we don't even remember it as that, but that has been repeated over and over again. When the kids were being imprisoned at the lunch pounds in Charlotte, when the riots came in Rock Hill, when Martin Luther King was put on the chain gang in Augusta. When Lord Russell, some of the people, I've seen some of the Band of Bomb symbols around here as jury, I hope they're more than that, were protesting against the placing of the bombs or the missiles in Great Britain. We look for a great voice from 231 Madison Avenue and from Minneapolis, from St. Louis, from Rome, and we've never heard it. And so I tell you, quite frankly, what people like myself say today, and others who are completely outside the church say, you know, it's too late. The shares have gone up. You can't buy in any longer. But we wonder, you have a right now. Well, we would carry the battle. Too late. The Spirit of Jesus is not dead. But the Spirit of Jesus has been working in the world. And in the world, the theological sense, apart from the church. If you want the Spirit of Jesus, maybe you're going to have to leave the church. That's just one of the possibilities. If you want to know Jesus Christ, you have to go outside Jerusalem.
So I have a question about what you're saying. One of the things that you began with, I guess it was Fred.
Pure rational, go ahead.
Said that one of the things you were most concerned about, one of the things that caused you pain, is that so many good people were leaving the church.
Yes.
Now you're giving advice that maybe that's what the good people should do.
Right.
And it sounds to me like there's a contradiction.
There is a contradiction. Maybe that's exactly what may happen, but if we're going to look at it from the point of view of bureaucrats,
well, it seems to me that you should have started out by saying one of the things that I'm the most happy about is that the good people are leaving the church because that's what they should do. Or otherwise ended up by saying, maybe the good people shouldn't leave the church.
I could do that and make a verbal non-contradiction. But my presence here would be a contradiction.
You see, that's what you seem to be saying. There was a situation in the early, before there was a church, when Christ spoke to the Pharisees and said, you whiten sepulchres, you.
Yeah.
And that there was something the matter there, but then what?
Well, that wasn't before there was a church.
No,
he was talking to the church.
But what happened then?
What happened what? What happened how? What do you mean? They obviously didn't change.
Well, what are you suggesting? See, it seems...
I don't know. Let's work down to that slowly. But one thing is sure. My presence here, not what I say, says that I want, if it is possible, not to have to leave the church and not to encourage others, but to reform.
You see, that's why I sort of...
Now, I don't know if it's possible.
You just made that meaning right. We should leave the church.
Right. I don't know if it's possible. Maybe we will have to. Maybe it's like sailors to try to save a stricken vessel as long as possible. And if it's possible to put up a collision map, if it's possible to put the holes in order, we can bring the ship in. Maybe, though, as sometimes they're heartbreaking, the ship has to be abandoned. The Coast Guard has to send it down. We have to get on another ship. I don't know.
Let us assume that there are present, say, for instance, in this room or in any audience that you happen to reach, a group of good young people who are contemplating what they can do to help the situation. That your concern seems to be, I don't quite know whether you're saying abandon the sinking ship or help save it.
My first answer would be, I want to take it over. That's the reason I don't like that he does. No, I'm really serious. Revolution, take the darn thing over. We've tried this, failed so far, most places, but take it over. We tried it at the youth committee. That's the only place we ever succeeded.
You are the person who does have the answer, so that...
No, I do not.
Then why do you want to take it over?
No, because at least we feel the problem. I don't believe anybody ever has an answer to any serious problem.
But do you feel that a person could take over an organization just because they sense a problem?
Yes.
Or because they have a solution in mind?
No, because they feel the problem. Anyone who feels he has a solution in mind already disqualified himself from my point of view.
From leadership?
Well, perhaps not from leadership, since actually those with the least idea are the best leaders.
If you take something over, you're actually assuming leadership, and it seems to me that some of the people most qualified to lead are not just those who sense the problem, but who also have some kind of... I mean, there are a lot of people who have done that, granted.
Oh, Hitler did it very well. He had an answer. But we've got a hand over here first. But you're quite right about it, Connor, Dick. Yeah.
I'm wondering whether you think, suppose that people, individuals, a group of people, have the spirit of Christ.
What people do
that? I can't hear that.
I think, suppose that an individual or a group of people have the spirit of Christ, would they know what to do? I mean, it's a,
no.
So there could be two problems. Maybe.
I love Christian love.
One of the problems, of course, is getting healed in our own centers.
Right.
Capable of grasping.
That's the first step, isn't it?
But then there would still be this other darn problem.
Right.
What do you do? Run around like a chicken with the head cut off?
No.
All right.
But you don't have an answer, I mean, when you get healed. In other words, you don't have an epistemological experience. You don't get knowledge out of being healed, out of being saved. I mean, this is pretty obvious.
But what if you have healing strength?
Over here first, please, sir.
So are you assuming that if you take over the church, then the church will be infallible and perfect? All right. The church is a community of broken, fallible human beings. Mm. And the church will always be broken and fallible.
Sure, surely. But does it have to be broken in the same place? And does it have to be helpless? Of course it will be fallible, but does it have to be helpless? Or perhaps a better word would be, does it have to be unwilling? I think that's what we're talking about.
Well, that's part of its fallibility.
Perhaps it's a part that's not necessary. The willingness to make mistakes is fallible, and yet it's kind of noble too. Perhaps it's the unwillingness. I really don't think the unwillingness is part of the nature of the fallibility of anything that exists. Yes, ma'am.
About voices from many outlets and so forth. I used to feel that way, that I wanted the church, the big Missouri Synod, to part of it. You know, we make pronouncements. But I've changed my mind quite a lot here, because in so many places where the church makes pronouncements, it makes them without knowledge. It lumps together all sorts of issues, some of which to most people are clearly ethical, and others which can be very political, like questions of foreign policy and so forth. Or now there's the whole abortion thing where the church body is drawing up lists and kind of thing. I think this may be a dangerous way to talk of church reform, to have the big bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not sure I want to keep, but anyway, you've got to,
I'm with you.
I don't know if I want them pronouncing. I would rather see the church remain the place where all Christians, even the segregationists, I have to fight all the time, so that he can be maybe in the church too. His sin also may be forgiven. Where they may come and celebrate, mm-hmm. and receive the sacraments. But out of this church, then, people are renewed are healed, and we move to that they, the individual Christian people, then can work in the world and pronounce and so forth.
I don't think
the church is doing this now. It's providing this kind of a community from which people may go forth. I think that is a stumbling block to its members.
I would think that what you say is exactly what the church intends to do, but it's not delivering this healing power.
No, I
would have to disagree with you. I don't know about keeping bureaucracy. I don't much like bureaucracy. I just feel, inevitable in anything. Before this week is over, there'll be a bureaucracy in here. Perhaps there already is. Groups just more or less tend to establish themselves in that way. Maybe the chimpanzees or the silver sands, I suppose, that picture we saw last night, sir. But I don't know, this kind of monkey always does, have an order. But I rather think that what you are saying is essentially a beautiful restatement of the Two Kingdoms doctrine again. And I would just have to observe as kind of a historian that we run these risks of bureaucracy rather than be quietistic, rather than be silent. Of course the church makes mistakes, and usually it does pronounce upon that which it is least capable of pronouncing upon. The things that it's capable of pronouncing upon, it stares away from because it's a hot issue. If you want to see a church, I would say that is living exactly the kind of regime that you mentioned, be the church in South Africa. Anybody that pronounces, writes a book, Alan Patton, or anybody that preaches a sermon, I've forgotten the bishop's name, there are at least two of them, he's out of the country.
Yeah.
Out. And so they stay there, and I'm sure, they're doing great things for the souls of the Afrikaans and so forth, just as in parts of our country. We're saving a lot of people's souls and letting their bodies go to hell and their personalities too. So I don't think that's the answer. That's the Two Kingdoms again.
She's
right about this business of being weak and infallible and not infallible. We have to make mistakes, but we have to say something. And I rather think what Camus had in mind was, I am concerned. That's what he wanted to hear Rome say.
Don't you think that when the bureaucracy is saying, I get tired of the silence too, but when it says it doesn't have then all the people that are in it, it seems to cry everybody down so that the big boys are trying to say this. We don't have to sweat so much. Now we've got a position. I'm tired of positions. I want people to do something.
Okay, then let's analyze that kind of a situation, why, in which a pronouncement is made. That would be the LCA right now. Well, it makes all kind of beautiful pronouncements, and it does nothing. Absolutely teetotal nothing, but it has the best pronouncements anywhere.
What would you do if you took it over?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to take over anything that big. Maybe that's what's wrong with it. But now, wait a minute. Let's analyze what's wrong between the big pronouncements and the doing nothing. Pretty obviously, what you've got is communication on a verbal level. Everybody that can read these pronouncements, so they can go to the biannual conventions and hear them. What is missing is the communication on the feeling level. What is missing is the emotional level. What is missing is the spiritual. There pretty obviously isn't any passage of the Spirit of Christ, which is one of outrage. At this point, what else could it be but the kind of thing he showed in the temple with the whip? What else could it be but the denunciation, don't weep for me, weep for Jerusalem. That's the level. And to qualify something that Fred brought up earlier about these younger men who apparently are going into psychology and sociology, they're becoming teachers, or even if they stay ordained, they get off and teach or something like this, or they open coffee houses, or whatever happens to be the outlet that they can find at the moment, is that they are the ones being communicated to on the proper wavelength, if you will. But once they are, they immediately become defective as part of the institution, which communicates on a verbal level. I mean, this is not to be considered a scientific description at all, just a topical description. So this is the problem. This is a real problem. You say, what would we do if these young people would take over the whole church, as in a sense they have taken over the youth commission. I think we have one small victory that we were afraid we'd lose there for a while because of the death, but we didn't apparently so far lose. I don't know what in the heck they would do. I haven't any idea. But I do know this. We might do, as W.H. Auden says in one of his poems, I think it was 1939, we might show an affirming flame. We might cast back signals to the people around us who feel problems, who feel in trouble, who are just, frankly, outraged and ready to revolt, ready to fight. I really don't think if you don't feel revolutionary today, you have any of the Spirit of Christ in you.
We need to stop.
Yeah, we got to stop.
We'll continue tonight and tomorrow morning.
10 o'clock, John.
Tonight at 10 right here?
Tonight at 10, right?